Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Where do the best ideas and innovations come from? Many of us envisioned that eureka moment, like Sir Isaac Newton coming up with the law of gravity when an apple fell on his head, or Alexander Graham Bell saying, "Watson, come over here," when he went over what became a telephone. Our guest today says and writes those kind of inventions and ideas aren't the result of a single moment, but much, much more, and we have much, much more to talk about with Stephen Johnson, bestselling author and media theorist. Mr. Johnson, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Stephen Johnson will be speaking at Penn State Harrisburg next Tuesday morning as part of PNC's Thought Leaders Lecture Series. So you'll get a little preview on Mr. Johnson's address for next Tuesday. As I mentioned, you will be speaking at Penn State Harrisburg on where good ideas come from. As I also mentioned in the introduction, not where many of us think of. Where do good ideas come from?
Well, as you said, we have this kind of mythology that we like to invoke for understandable reasons, I think, which really involves two key ingredients, one of which is the kind of the genius, the isolated genius, kind of alone in their lab, and then the idea of the eureka moment, where the genius has this sudden inspiration and, you know, as you said, the apple falls from the tree and, oh, I've got a theory of gravity and the world changes because of this moment of sudden insight and illumination. And those kinds of narratives are appealing because, you know, they make for a good story and they're kind of dramatic and there's a hero and a sudden moment of clarity, which is nice to hear. But in fact, if you go back, as I've tried to do over now many books, 11 books actually is the last one, if you look at the history of ideas that change the world in many fields, technological fields, scientific fields, business fields, whatever, what you find is actually that the process is very different from that lone genius eureka moment model. And the two, you know, key elements that you see in practice are that ideas are much more likely to form in networks, kind of collaborative networks, where people contribute small pieces to the puzzle. And they're much slower. And the word that the phrase that I use to describe this is, instead of a eureka moment, most really transformative ideas are what I call slow hunches. And they start with this kind of inkling of possibility, a sense that there's something worth exploring, and without really a clear idea of where it's going to lead you. And, you know, after months, years, sometimes a decade of tinkering with that idea, it slowly evolves into something that is really a truly transformative idea. There's a great example of that in I may talk about it at Penn State next week, which is the invention of the World Wide Web. Tim Berners-Lee inventing the web in the 1980s. Like he did this really over a 6 or 7 year period, starting as a young programmer at CERN, the great Swiss physics lab, and he was just hired as a programmer working among all these brilliant scientists. And he decided to create a little application just to keep track of all the people there, because he was meeting all these brilliant people, these Nobel laureates and everything like that. And so he created, just for his own personal use, a little program that would basically connect through a kind of hypertext the people he met, who they were collaborating with, the papers that they were writing and publishing and so on, the projects they were working on. And he used that little tool just for his own use for a couple of years, and then he started thinking, well, maybe there's something slightly bigger here, and he did another iteration of it. And then a full 5 years passed before he began to think, wait a second, you know, this could actually be a new communications platform. And so it's, you know, the lesson of this is that, you know, if you spend your life or set up your organization seeking out sudden moments of clarity and trying to do it all on your own, you won't be as successful. It's better to have the patience to let these hunches evolve over time.
That slow hunch, one of the striking things about, and you've written about this, is that one thing kind of leads to another, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's the willingness to be led. You know, There's a major kind of psychological category that psychologists talk about, the kind of big five personality traits. And one of them, which is kind of my favorite one, is what they call openness to experience, which is also another word for that is sometimes curiosity, right? And what you see in a lot of these people who have been involved, like Tim Berners-Lee, with transformative ideas, is this willingness to just follow ideas purely for curiosity's sake, and to not always have a clear functional objective in mind, but just like, this is interesting. I'm gonna follow this thread a little bit longer, even though it's really not clear to me why. I just find something kind of fascinating about it, and that leads you then to another idea, another breakthrough, another additional kind of piece of the puzzle that eventually starts to turn into something really, really big.
Now, that example you gave is of a single person, but one of the things that you write is that creativity is often better when a group of people get together. And again, this goes away from that myth of that single inventor, the Edisons, and I'm going to ask about Edison in just a moment, but whether someone who sat there on their own for years toiling over this and then all of a sudden had that eureka moment. But you write that a group of people actually are more creative.
Absolutely. It's a big, maybe the biggest kind of theme of all of my work. Give you two examples. Berners-Lee with the web is an interesting case because he really does create more or less on his own the underlying kind of architecture of the web, technically, which is unusual. That in the history of most technologies, that really is not what happens. But if you think about the web, it really didn't become a mainstream thing until they added the ability to include images on a web page. That was the first point in which it started to feel like media and not just, some kind of computer text. And that was created by a different group of researchers in the early 90s, the folks who ended up breaking up and forming Netscape, but at the time were at university in Illinois. And so even Berners-Lee required help. It wasn't a sole invention, his sole creation. But there are many other examples. I wrote this book about a cholera outbreak in London in the 1850s called The Ghost Map, which is a story of both a terrible outbreak, but also the discovery of what was causing cholera in the first place. Everybody thought cholera was in the air, something you breathed in, when in fact we now know cholera was in the water. And to combat cholera, you need to purify the water supply. So this was a transformative idea. Once you began to see it as a waterborne disease, you could treat it for the first time. And everybody always attributes this breakthrough to this brilliant doctor, John Snow, in London, who figured out that in the middle of this outbreak that this pump where people were getting their water had become contaminated. And he's famous for going in front of the board and a health board and saying, close down this pump. This is what's making people sick. And, it's always told as the story of this one guy and his kind of fearless battle against the authorities. And while Snow is a great hero, he's one of my personal heroes, it turned out, as I dug into the research of that book, that he had this collaborator that no one talked about who was crucial to the story, who, interestingly, was a local vicar, was not a man of science or medicine or public health at all. He was basically a minister. But he was someone who knew everyone in the neighborhood. He was a very social figure, had a very kind of thick on-the-ground knowledge of everyone's personal lives and connections and so on. And he, for complicated reasons, he got involved in the investigation as well of this outbreak. And because he knew so many people, he was able to build up a lot of the data for Snow's research because he could find people who'd fled the neighborhood in fear and all this kind of stuff. And he tracked down ultimately what became the patient zero that kind of started the whole outbreak in the first place. And there's a real argument to be made that without this other figure, Snow wouldn't have been able to convince the authorities of his theory. And so the lesson in that, I think, is both that it's rarely just one person, but also that what makes a successful collaboration is diversity of skills inside the network of people collaborating. So Snow was a brilliant scientists and epidemiologists, and Whitehead, who was the name of the vicar, had great social intelligence and kind of local knowledge. And you put those two things together and you have something that's, you know, that's greater than the sum of its parts.
I mentioned Thomas Edison. And again, maybe there are some myths surrounding Edison, the inventor. But did he work with other people? Because, you know, so often in history, we think about Edison as being this lone, brilliant inventor, you know, so many patents to his name, but he did it all on his own.
Yeah, so there are two levels of the story. I mean, the short answer is no. He did not do it all on his own. And there are two ways in which that myth is not true, one of which is maybe slightly more critical of Edison, one of which I think is more positive about Edison. And we did, a couple of years ago, I did this series for PBS, which we also did a book on, called How We Got to Now, and we shot a whole sequence in the Edison Museum outside of Cleveland. And we said a bunch of things that were somewhat critical of Edison, and I always felt like the museum staff were, you know, angrily looking at us as I was saying all these scandalous lines about Edison. So the part of it is, you know, every school kid knows that Thomas Edison invented the light bulb, right? That is what, you know, that's what up there with Graham Bell and the telephone. I mean, this is, you know, this is one of those canonical truths that you hear, and it's simply not true. Like, in the period that Edison, while he was working on the light bulb, there were a dozen people in the United States and in Europe who were actively inventing light bulbs and did successfully create electric light bulbs of various forms. And this is something we see again and again in history, that no one was working on electric light in 1810 or 1820 or 1830, but then by, you know, 1865, 1870, 1875, there were a dozen people working on it. Certain ideas become kind of imaginable. We didn't understand enough about electricity in 1810 to even think about creating a stable electric light, but we had advanced in our knowledge by the second half of that century, and so suddenly everybody's working on it. So there were lots of people inventing light bulbs during that period, and Edison was aware of them, and Edison borrowed from their ideas. In some cases, he acquired their ideas through, you know, acquiring patents for innovations. And so what Edison did was build the first kind of commercially viable, long-lasting light bulb. But he did it by drawing upon lots of work that was happening outside of his lab. Hmm. The second part of it, which is much really to his credit, and is that he built a great diverse team at his lab in, I think at that point they were in, I can't remember if they were in Menlo Park at that point, but he had a group of people he called the Muckers, and they were, you know, folks who he deliberately put together with different kind of skills that, you know, some of them were like what we would now call a chemical engineer or something like that, someone who was a specialist in electricity, someone who was really good with material science, et cetera. And he kind of created what we now think of as a research and development lab. You know, get a bunch of people who are really good at different fields and let them tinker and give them some guidance, but also let them experiment and try different things and stuff like that. And so he did create this group around him that helped him refine the ideas that had actually been developed really all around the world in terms of electric light.
More fascinating stories from Stephen Johnson coming up. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Our guest during this portion of the program is Stephen Johnson, best-selling author and media theorist. And I have to say that just describing Mr. Johnson that way seems like an understatement, because the man has written 11 books. As he mentioned, the PBS series from a few years ago, How We Got to Now, just does a whole lot. Considered one of the world's great thinkers when it comes to innovation. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I have to ask this question, though. When I say one of the world's great thinkers when it comes to innovation, that's your reputation. That's quite a reputation to uphold, isn't it?
Well, it's very nice of you to describe me like that. You know, it's funny. I didn't. I kind of got into this in a funny way. Like I didn't. I just always been. If you look at the books that I've done, they've been on a really kind of crazy range of topics, like, you know, cholera, and then I wrote one about video games, and then contemporary neuroscience, and the, you know, like they're all over the place. But what I realized when I kind of stepped back is that they all are about new ideas coming into the world, right? And sometimes those new ideas are happening right now, and, you know, it's some new development in brain science that we were only able to imagine because of fMRI machines in the last 20 years. And sometimes it's like, you know, the Jon Snow and Henry Whitehead discovering the mystery of cholera in the 1850s. It happened a long time ago. But that process is just something that I find it really interesting intellectually, and the nice thing about it is that it often makes for good stories. But the tricky thing, and this is something we wrestled with a lot in when we were making How We Got to Now for TV, is if the truth of it is that ideas come from, you know, a network of a dozen people working in different places, collaborating pieces, you know, sharing pieces of the puzzle, that's a harder story to tell, particularly on TV, right? It's so much easier when you have that one brilliant hero who's going, think about how many, you know, kind of smart movies are about, you know, the Alan Turing-like figure who's rebelling against the authorities and everybody thinks is crazy, but in fact has the secret. You know, it's so much easier to tell that story when there's one, you know, maverick who you're trying to celebrate. And so it's trying to figure out narrative ways that you can represent a group rather than just one hero.
I want to ask another question about your theories on innovation when people are in a group and they are more creative. You know, what actually, how does that come to be? Why are people more creative when they're a group of people? And I think that, you know, the answer is probably self-explanatory, but what are some of the characteristics that come out of a group of people meeting?
It's a really good question, actually. And some of them are, you know, maybe intuitive, and then some of them are, I think, a little bit surprising, some of the explanations. And there's been a lot of really good research into this in the last 20 or 30 years. The first is that a lot of innovations come from borrowing ideas across, or kind of transporting ideas or metaphors across disciplinary borders. So someone creates a tool or a technology or a way of framing a problem in one field, and someone working on a different problem in a different field kind of borrows some of the framework and kind of ports it over into that new field and says, oh, wait, this changes everything if I look at it from this angle. And so there's a great story about Apple when they were coming up with the design for the Apple stores, the retail stores, which are now the most profitable retail environment on the planet by square foot. They, in trying to figure out how to reinvent the whole shopping experience, instead of studying their direct competitors, they went and studied high-end hotels. Like, they sent their people to study Ritz-Carlton and take the training program at Ritz-Carlton, which would seem to be a totally different problem. They weren't making hotels. They were making a consumer electronics store. But they came back and they said, you know what everybody really likes in a high-end hotel? They like a concierge, like a really good concierge is a great feature of a five-star hotel. And so they thought, well, what would be the equivalent of a concierge in a consumer electronics store? And then they kind of came up with this idea of the Genius Bar as, you know, a port of that idea from hotels brought over into consumer electronics. And now, you know, it's a huge success and stuff like that. So that's one reason why diverse groups are really valuable, because you know, you're working on a problem in computer science, but you're talking to your architecture friend, and your architecture friend mentions something about the way they think about the flow in a building, and you think, well, what if my application was, if I imagined it in the same way that you're thinking about a building, and that unlocks a whole new way of seeing the problem. So diversity is really important in that way. The other thing that there have been interesting studies of group dynamics in, like, labs, and where they just videotape hours and hours and hours and, you know, kind of biotech labs and things like that, and they record where the big ideas come from. And they find that one of these studies found that the big breakthrough ideas would come at the weekly lab meeting when everyone would get together and share what they were working on. So again, that group network environment. And oftentimes what would happen is that someone would be working on their research project and they'd be like, oh, I'm just stuck. You know, I keep getting this error in my data and I can't figure out what's causing the error. And someone else with fresh eyes on the problem would say, wait a second, I don't think that's an error. Like, I think you're getting a really interesting result. You've been looking for this result, but in fact the result you're getting is not a mistake. You actually have discovered something. And suddenly that would unlock a whole door and stuff like that.
So another set of eyes and thinking
about
it.
Another set of eyes, exactly.
Your 2016 book is Wonderland, How Play Made the Modern World. You say that people have often found innovations when they were playing and not necessarily looking to find innovation. Why do you say that?
Well, it's related to what we were talking about earlier about curiosity and openness to experience. With that book, I set out initially just to kind of write a history of things that people did for fun, right? A history of delight. And, you know, it was just because I thought that would be interesting in and of itself, right? You know, what's the history of board games? You know, what's the history of optical illusions that eventually led to things like moving pictures and so on? And as I researched it, the more I dug in, the more I realized that there was this whole history of really transformative big ideas, you know, serious ideas, that first took root in kind of playful experiments that did not have a clear functional purpose or utility, that were just people mucking around having a little bit of fun. And so I began to realize how important that playful mentality is in driving progress and change in society.
I have to tell you that one story in particular that you've written about and talked about that I just absolutely love, and I think that our audience would find it very fascinating too, and that is the explanation or description of how the programmable computer came to be. It goes back hundreds, maybe thousands of years, actually starting with a flute made from the bones of extinct animals. Could I get you to tell that story?
Yeah, it's a crazy one. Well, if you go back to the bone flutes, it takes you back about 50,000 years.
Yeah.
It's one of those long stories.
Yeah, it is thousands of years. Yeah.
I mean, this is an example of how deep-seated our desire for kind of play and delight is, right? So some of the earliest artifacts of human ingenuity are these bone flutes that are at least maybe even as old as 60,000 years old, right? And they're basically these flutes that have been carved out of a kind of hollow animal bone that can play recognizable tones to our modern musically trained ears. And so you think about our ancestors 60,000 years ago, there's a whole world that they haven't invented yet, right? The whole world, they haven't invented wheels and alphabets and currency systems and all that kind of stuff. And so what do they decide to invent next? They decide to invent a flute, which is totally not functional at all. So even in those early days, we were like trying to do things just for the purpose of delight, as well as doing things, you know, for survival value and so on. So it's a deep part of our history. So fast forward to Baghdad about 1,000 years ago at the height of the Islamic Renaissance. And there's a bunch of engineers there who start creating these mechanical toys that we now call automatons, that are like mini kind of robots and that are lifelike in this kind of miraculous way. Again, no purpose. They're just some of the most advanced engineering in the world to create little moving dolls, basically. They're not functional in any way. And one of them, maybe the most important one, is an automated flute player. Again, flutes for some reason. But what makes this flute player so extraordinary is that it is controlled by this kind of cylinder that has it's like a music box. It has little kind of physical bars on the outside of the cylinder, and as it rotates, it controls the notes that the automated flute player plays, right? And it's called a pinned cylinder because of the pins on the outside that control the notes. And what makes this invention so important is that it was specifically designed so that if you wanted the kind of robot to play a different song, you could take the cylinder out, encode a new set of notes on a new cylinder and put it in, and it would play a completely different song. And so that is really the first time in the history of technology that we see a programmable machine, a machine that is kind of open-ended in what it can do. It can play one song, or if you want to program it to play a different song, it'll play a different song. And that leads to, eventually, to centuries later, to a whole host of automatons that were invented in the 1700s controlled in a similar way by these pin cylinders. And eventually people started to think, well, wait a second, maybe I could control a loom. I could actually use that same principle. Instead of creating music, I could use it to create fabrics, which would be a little bit more functional because textile industry is a big part of the world at that point. And eventually a guy named Jacquard creates a loom based on this idea, except that he decides to encode the instructions for the patterns that it should create on what are called punch cards, punched paper cards, instead of this mechanical.
It's something we recognize now.
Exactly. So this is the early 1810s, 1820s. And so there's coding now for something functional, but it's on paper, punch paper cards. And in England, a guy named Charles Babbage is directly inspired by this guy's Jacquard's punch paper cards, and he uses that to program the first programmable computer, his analytic engine that he tries to build in the 1830s. And that legacy of punch cards, as you suggest, continues. I mean, I remember them as a grade schooler in the 70s, that the computer we had in our school, you know, was still being kind of controlled by punch cards. And so, I mean, the point of this is really, like, if you ask yourself, where did programmable computing come from? Where did the idea of hardware and software first come from? We think of it as being like, traditionally, it's like, well, it came from the war effort, it came from Alan Turing, it came from trying to crack these codes, the Enigma code, and that is partially true, for sure. Those are an important part of the story. But it also came from automated flute players and people trying to make lovely fabrics and people making these weird dancing music-playing dolls. And that's, if you only tell the kind of military story and the big business story, you miss an important part of where those ideas came from.
Fascinating story. Now, we're almost out of time, but I want to thank you very much for being with us today and look forward to seeing you next Tuesday at Penn State Harrisburg. Do you aim to inspire? Because a lot of what you write, a lot of what you talk about, I can see it as being inspirational for many people and coming up with innovations, coming up with good ideas.
Yeah, and that was a big reason why we did How We Got to Now, the show, too, which was to take that to television and say, you know, it turned out to be a really fun show for, like, a 10-year-old to watch. Like, it's a great family show. And part of it was to say, listen, here are these great stories about people who changed the world through their collaborative networks and their, you know, and their genius. But we still have a lot of other problems to solve. Like, we're not done. So get out there and you know, try and contribute on your own.
Stephen Johnson, best-selling author, media theorist. He'll be at Penn State Harrisburg next Tuesday morning at 11:30 as part of PNC's Thought Leaders Lecture Series. Thank you very much for being with us today.
I really enjoyed it.
And again, as I mentioned, that will be next Tuesday. That is the third in PNC's Thought Leaders Lecture Series. Jin Hoen, who is the PNC Regional President for Central Pennsylvania, is with us now. Mr. Hoen, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing well. You had to be fascinated by the conversation with Stephen Johnson, who's going to be part of your lecture series next week.
Oh, my goodness. You know, it just reinforced our selection of Stephen Johnson as we look to get really some renowned thinkers and innovators to come to town to really help us come together to make a difference in the future here.
Well, tell us about the PNC Thought Leaders Lecture Series. What are you looking to do?
Yeah, probably about 3 years ago, sitting down with Chancellor Kulkarni at Penn State Harrisburg, we were thinking long and hard about how we bring the disparate talents together in this marketplace. Those of academics, those of business people, those of students, those of just the average citizens in the market, along with civic leaders, and say, you know, we know this is a great place to live, work, and play, but, you know, the world's changing quite a bit, and so how can we bring folks together? How can we make them, that's how we do encourage them to collaborate so we can even have a better community 15, 20 years down the road and be inclusive of all of our citizens? So through the course of time, Stephen Johnson will be our third speaker. But our focus has been on those folks who can bring folks together to create dialogue, to encourage an exchange of ideas, in more than anything else, prompt thought and develop collaboration.
PNC, obviously, a financial institution. I understand that one of the goals of the lecture series is to spark the local economy. In what way?
Well, I think that there is a much that can happen in terms of the economy here. You know, obviously, we're very good at things like agribusiness, electrical connectors. Certainly, we're the snack food capital of the world in South Central Pennsylvania. But there's so much more going on in terms of technology and being more inclusive of getting the talents of all moving forward. And this can be everything from manufacturing and to high-end technology. And there's so much talent in this market, but I do think it's coming together in terms of thinking collaboratively about the resources we have, both in terms of intellectual, in terms of natural resources, in terms of the academic and training resources. And while things are good, we think things can always be better on that front. And we as PNC certainly are focused on helping that be better. Clearly, from a business standpoint, the more robust the region is, the better business that we can do in the market. But it's also where, you know, it's where our families live. It's where we play. It's where our kids are. It's where our friends are. And we know that the world's changing so fast these days that the more that we can come together to help solve problems, help develop solutions, help encourage each other, that's what we're all about.
I asked Stephen Johnson this question about whether he was looking to inspire. I'll ask you the same question. Is that one of the goals here, to inspire some actions, inspire some innovation, some thinking?
Yeah, I think it is about all inspiring actions and thinking. The more that we can develop the ideas here that then organically can continue, I think is really what our broadest aspiration is about. You know, the sessions like the one we'll have next week on the 13th, they're going to be great and they're going to be informative, and I think everybody will enjoy it and will be inspired. But I think the bigger goal for all of us is to create this organic environment where this happens every day. There's a lot of great things going on in terms of some of the incubation of great ideas. And I must give a plug for a friend of mine, Kevin Harder, who's really taken the lead on working on this effort right now. But a lot of the innovation, he's the director for the Center for Medical Information, Medical Innovation at Penn State College of Medicine. And a lot of what Penn State more broadly is doing with the Invent Penn State is really bringing disparate groups together to really focus on economic development. And this is just one aspect where PNC is involved to help us bring that together. But let me just reiterate, I think our broadest aspiration here is to used events like this to bring people together, develop ideas, but it serves as a catalyst so we can create this ongoing or organic mechanism where we continue to work together from disparate fields, much like Stephen Johnson just talked about, to address the issues and opportunities that lay in front of us.
Stephen Johnson will be speaking at Penn State Harrisburg next Tuesday morning at 11:30. It's part of PNC's Thought Leaders Lecture Series. Jim Hohen, PNC Regional President for Central PA. Jim, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We are in the midst of Leak Week. That pithy name brings awareness to and refers to a very serious medical condition known as spinal cerebrospinal fluid or brain spinal fluid leak. Spinal CSF leak can cause disabling headaches, and oftentimes it goes undiagnosed. With us today to talk about the CFS leak is Dr. Connie DeLine, Vice President and Chair of the Medical Advisory Board of the Spinal CSF Leak Foundation. Dr. DeLine, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, 1-800-729-7532. All right, what is CSF leak?
CSF is the abbreviation for cerebrospinal fluid. Cerebral meaning brain, spinal. And that fluid is really a watery fluid that surrounds and bathes the brain and spinal cord, important for normal neurologic function. So a spinal CSF leak is when there's a leakage of that fluid somewhere that causes a loss in the volume of fluid. When it occurs at the level of the spine, we call it a spinal CSF leak. And that causes neurologic symptoms ranging from headache to a number of other serious neurologic symptoms. But the most common symptom is headache that is positional.
We're going to talk about all those things in just a moment, but I mentioned that the theme of this week, or the name of this awareness week, is Leak Week, and there's a little theme that goes to it. Because your dura matters is the theme. What does that mean, because your dura matters?
Right. The theme, because your dura maters, is actually a play on words. If you look at the spelling, we're spelling it...
I noticed that, and I didn't know whether you were going to pronounce it that way or with matters, but go ahead.
Yes, it's not a typo. It's spelled D-U-R-A, dura, mater, M-A-T-E-R, so that's the play on words, mater, maters. Dura mater is the tough leather-like tissue that holds CSF in around the brain and spinal cord. So, you know, where the tagline basically focuses in on the cause of leak, which is a tear or a hole in the dura mater. So basically, your dura matters because if it's not intact, it will leak fluid and then cause all of these neurologic symptoms and headache.
So how common is this?
There are different reasons to have a spinal CSF leak. It can be from trauma, it can be from medical procedures, or they can happen out of the blue. And so each of those categories has a different incidence and prevalence. And we don't really have really good information on how common they are. We think that the medical procedures related group is the largest, just because those procedures are common. A spinal tap, you know, when people has a lumbar puncture for, you know, sampling some fluid for testing.
Something we don't like to picture, by the way.
Right. So, but most people know someone who's had a spinal tap. And sometimes when you inject when you pierce the dura with a needle, normally that little hole will seal over right away. But it doesn't always. So they can inject some blood over that to patch it up, and it's dealt with. Most of the time, it's an easy fix. So that would be the most common type of spinal CSF leak that causes this positional headache and other symptoms. It can also happen from surgery. Spine surgery is pretty common, and 5% of spine surgeries are complicated by a nick or a tear in that dura. So there you have a leak. And those can resolve fairly easily, and some of them don't resolve that easily. They may require repeated repairs to fix that up. So those are common. Epidural injections, spinal epidurals, epidurals that are done for labor can accidentally nick the dura, and that happens pretty commonly. The exact prevalence is hard to estimate because these complication rates haven't really been well studied, but they're not uncommon. The spontaneously occurring type of leak that happens just out of the blue to anybody at any age, male or female, we don't have really good information on how prevalent it is. We're basing it on one study from an emergency department where people were really sick. It was estimated to be occurring at 5 per 100,000 per year, but we know that that's a gross underestimate. We know that it happens to far more people because not everyone with this ends up in the emergency room.
Something else that I understand happens very often is a misdiagnosis as well, right?
Correct. If we speak with the expert centers that are treating these patients and ask them what percentage of patients that come to you were misdiagnosed before they came to you, they will say 90-95%
wow.
Plus. Most of those patients are diagnosed with migraine headache or tension headache or a whole bunch of other, you know, diagnoses. Sometimes they're told that they're malingering, that they're crazy, that they're anxious or depressed. It's just really a condition that is unknown to the vast majority of physicians, so it's under-recognized and therefore misdiagnosed as another type of headache. But the point is, this type of headache has an underlying cause that can be fixed. And because it has an underlying cause that can be fixed, you really have to know about it so that you can try to fix it and cure it. Not everyone's cured, but a high percentage can be.
You mentioned the headache. What are the symptoms other than that headache? And describe what that headache is like, but some of the other symptoms as well.
Sure. The headache from a spinal CSF leak tends to be positional, meaning it tends to be worse when you're upright. And that change in severity of headache with position change may be relatively abrupt, within seconds or minutes, or it can escalate after someone rises to being upright after several hours. When people first get it, they tend to have a more abruptly worsening when they get upright. Once they've had it for a while, it becomes often less abrupt. But there tends to be, in general, this positional aspect. After minutes to hours upright, the headache is worse. You lay down, you feel better. You get up in the morning, you feel great. You can even have a second half of the day headache pattern, which is common. Kind of do okay all morning, and then by afternoon, I need to go to bed. The headache's that bad. It can be, for some patients, they aren't that disabled by it, but for many patients, it's profoundly disabling. Some patients can only be upright for a few minutes at a time here and there and really live most of their life in bed. So it's important to recognize so that it can be tested to find out where is the leak and hopefully successfully treated.
What about the other symptoms, though? It's for some people, it's not just a headache.
Correct. Most people experience headache that's usually, although not always, positional. The other common symptoms are nausea, sometimes vomiting, dizziness, pain in the neck, sometimes some pain between the shoulder blades, sometimes arm tingling or numbness. The hearing changes. People can have muffled hearing or ringing in their ears or actual hearing loss. People can have pain in their face, pain in their sinuses. Sometimes it gets misdiagnosed as sinusitis. I should mention that the headache most frequently is at the back of the head, at the bottom back of the head, but any headache pattern can occur.
What you just described, I can understand why it is misdiagnosed so often, because many of them, those symptoms do sound like a migraine or do sound like other medical conditions.
Yes, absolutely. And there's actually a lot of other symptoms that are maybe not quite as common, like tremor, can be misdiagnosed as Parkinson's. So, but the most common symptom of headache, daily headache, the most common misdiagnosis is migraine headache, chronic daily headache, tension headache, transform migraine, occipital neuralgia. Those are common labels that people get if a physician has never heard of this as a cause of headache and hasn't really teased out the positional nature. Oh, do you feel better in the morning? Oh, and you feel worse later in the day. So teasing that information out can be helpful in raising the index of suspicion that maybe this could be this curable type of headache.
Our guest during this portion of the program is Dr. Connie DeLine, Vice President and Chair of the Medical Advisory Board of the Spinal CSF Leak Foundation. It is Leak Week, bringing awareness to spinal CSF leak. 1-800-729-7532 is our phone number if you have a question or a comment, or you can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page or on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. You are in Camp Hill. You live in Camp Hill.
Yes.
But I also understand that you were someone who suffered a leak.
Yes.
Tell us about that. What happened?
Well, a number of years ago, I was an individual, practicing family medicine, and out of the blue, over the course of about 30 minutes, having had zero headaches in my life, I developed a very severe headache. So I went from entirely well to bedridden with severe headache and vomiting within just 30 minutes.
So, I mean, as a physician, what did you suspect?
I was really so in so much pain that I really couldn't think. But fortunately, I did see a neurologist within a couple of days who did make the correct diagnosis. Unlike many patients who don't get their correct diagnosis right off the bat, I did get the correct diagnosis.
What caused your leak?
My leak was caused by a tear in the spinal dura that caused a large amount of CSF to leak out.
Do you remember how that occurred? I mean, you're always probably asking yourself, how did I tear the dura?
My case was spontaneous, and we know from surgical repairs that I had later that I have abnormally weak and thin dura. Mm. And that's one of the predisposing factors. Some patients can have a heritable disorder of connective tissue that causes that normally leather-like membrane to be thinner and weaker and more easily tear.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a phone call here in just a moment, 1-800-729-7532. We've talked about symptoms, some of the causes. What about treatments?
The treatments focus on treating the underlying leak, the hole in the dura. The most common treatment is called an epidural blood patch. Epidural blood patch is an injection of blood in the space just outside the dura in the spinal region and can kind of patch up the hole and in many cases will be curative. There are other types of spinal injection procedures, but in some cases surgical repair is needed.
We have a phone call from Steve, who is driving through central Pennsylvania. Steve, you're on the air.
Yeah, hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
So, my question is, my wife is actually currently suffering from intracranial hypertension, which is the opposite problem to the leak. However, it was only discovered October of last year when our doctor finally read the report from 2011. But she's been suffering migraines, arm tingling, back of the neck, you know, back of the brain, headaches, literally every single symptom that you're explaining. And my question is, can a cerebral spinal leak turn into intracranial hypertension if the leak heals itself or disappears?
Doctor?
Yes. In patients that have had intracranial hypotension, which is the loss of CSF from a spinal CSF leak, in those patients, if it spontaneously heals or if it's been treated with patching procedures or with surgery, it's not unusual for the intracranial pressure to become elevated and remain so for a period of time. So that's called intracranial hypertension or elevated intracranial pressure, which, as you said, is the opposite of the low pressure CSF problem.
We're right, not being vertical actually alleviates the symptoms as opposed to laying down. She cannot sleep flat. She has to sleep elevated, or she wakes up with severe migraines, and it's quite troublesome. Mm.
Hey, Steve, thank you very much for your call. I mean, is that common, or is it related, as I think was his question?
It sounds like she actually has high pressure is her problem rather than low. But yeah, they can be related. You can go from low to high.
We only have about 30 seconds left. And Dr. DeLon, I want to thank you very much for being with us and bringing attention to spinal CSF leak. If there are people out there, because I'm sure there are a lot of people who are hearing about this for the first time, what should they do in about 30 seconds or less?
Sure. I think arming themselves with a little bit more information and understanding, our website certainly has a lot of information about symptoms and how to diagnose and treat it. But certainly, you know, take some of that information and talk with your physicians about, could my headache be due to a spinal CSF leak rather than migraine?
Dr. Connie DeLine, Vice President and Chair of the Medical Advisory Board of the Spinal CSF Leak Foundation, thank you very much for being with us today. Coming up on tomorrow's program, best-selling author Janice Kaplan on her latest book, How Luck Happens. Also, Sunday is Pennsylvania Charter Day, a birthday for the state that comes up on Sunday.